Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. And deliver us from evil. What is that? Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory forever and ever. Amen. Some of you followed along. I've been praying that prayer a lot recently. It's not one in my common vocabulary. I stumble across some of the words. I confessed this to my spiritual director the other day. She's a Mennonite pastor, and she says, me too. I mean, the beginning, right? Our Father. Boom. Just makes me want to stop. I've been praying this a lot recently because the children who are now in our lives, because we are doing foster care, it's important for their family that each day they pray. And so each evening we gather together, sitting down in one of their bedrooms, and we pray the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. It sticks in my throat some of the time. I mean, it's not a prayer that's mine. It never has been. I've never was raised in a tradition in which this prayer was meaningful. It's not something that I have a relationship with. And I'm not sure that I want to. And yet each night we gather and we sit down and we take a breath and we try to corral ourselves and we say these same words over and over again. It's been about 25 days of this practice. And I will confess that I'm surprised at how my relationship has changed to this prayer. There's something maybe not inherent in it, but there's something that is unlocked within me. I mean, especially when I get to that part where we say, what is it? Forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. And you look at two kids that have been terrorizing your life. I mean, I'm joking. They're wonderful. And they're also kids, right? Get some amens from the parents in the audience. And it's both, right? I look at them and I think about my day and the ways that I wished I would have acted towards them, those moments where I was a bit too abrupt, the things I wish I would have said, the ways in which I didn't live up to even my expectations of myself. And so I'm like, forgive me my trespasses as I forgive those who trespass against us. It's kind of beautiful. It shifted my heart. I mean, every second day, I wonder if I can throw an Our Mother in there or bring in some different translations of this prayer, but I don't. There's something about this prayer and to honor the wishes of this family that I need to comport myself to, not comport it to me. There is a submission, in a sense, a giving up of my control, of my you righteousness, and surrendering to the moment and realizing that, wow, love and power can still come through imperfect words. What we repeat becomes habit. Our habits become our lives, and our lives are everything. What we repeat becomes habit. Our habits become our lives, and our lives are everything. Now, as religious liberals, we tend to shy away from words like discipline. I was kind of joking last week with one of the services that, like, Gretchen did punishment last week, and now we're doing discipline for 4 weeks. What's next? I said, maybe flagellation in December? Discipline is harsh. It is coercive. It is imposed, much of the time without our choice. We bristle at the word because it takes away our freedom. and especially in the religious world, where as Unitarian Universalists, many of us have found a home in our faith because we are free from the coercive impulses of religious doctrine or the illogical and harmful practices of a faith that we've left behind. We don't want discipline in our religion because we came here to escape maybe the discipline of another. And yet, it's interesting, if you go back to the founding documents of our Unitarian Universalist faith back in the ancient days of 1961, when the Unitarians and the Universalists, who even after flirting for centuries, finally joined together as one denomination, when they wrote the principles that were going to knit these two faiths together, the first one was a free and disciplined search for truth and meaning. We've shifted that when we edited the principles in 85 to be a free and responsible search for truth and meaning, but that word discipline made an appearance, not only in the pumpkin carving, but in our faith. There's something about a discipline of applying one's self to life, of not comporting life, but comporting ourselves to the truths. Us religious liberals tend to want a faith that is more like a choose-your-own-adventure story, right? You get to the next page and you look down and you're like, okay, I don't like option A. I don't like option B. Don't like option C. Maybe I'll turn to option D. Or what many of you probably do would be like, I don't like any of those ones. So now I'm going to write my own story, right? I love that impulse in us. I love this impulse because it allows us to sidestep what can become the idolatries of religious practice, doing things because we've always done them, accepting the authority of people who shouldn't be an authority. And yet, as we walk away from the concept of discipline, we lose something. As we search a freedom, free of coercion, free of being told what to do, free of having to comport ourselves, we lose sometimes a deeper freedom. Because the freedom to be free from coercion is only one half of the freedom coin. The other half is the freedom to actually do something with that freedom. I wrote about it in that series flyer there and in the email you got about my experience the other day at the gym. I was approaching the weights and I was looking at all of the numbers trying to figure out which one I could actually lift. And I realized that I was free to pick up any of the weights. Like, no one was telling me not to. And yet there were many, if not most, of the weights on that weight bench that I was not free to pick up. I had not built up the capacity to exercise that freedom. Exercise that freedom. It's a good one. And there are many things that are like that in our lives, that we actually have to exercise ourselves. Exercise ourselves to build up the capacity to live into a freedom, to live into the capacity to do that thing that you've always wanted to do, or to not react when someone says something with harshness but with compassion, to build that skill, that craft, that art, maybe in your career or in your family or in justice work, that it takes a discipline to cultivate those habits within ourselves that allow us the freedom to do that into the world. One of my favorite philosophers, Charles Taylor, calls this freedom an exercise freedom. Because we need to exercise the will, exercise the capacity to enact the freedom. That it's not just that someone isn't telling us that we can't do it. We have to do something. And we have to not only decide in a moment what we want to do, which is sometimes challenging, to figure out what we want to grow into and to become, especially in our faith and our spiritual lives when we are given freedom to grow in many ways. But then we actually have to do the disciplined work of getting there. The root of the word exercise is actually to break down. When you're exercising your muscles, you actually are tearing the muscles apart, forcing your body to re-knit them together stronger. It is a painful experience to exercise this freedom because it asks us a certain discipline, a discipline of building those habits, the habits that become our lives. And of course, our lives are everything. But for those disciplines to take effect, to be able to exercise that freedom to do and be what we want to, those disciplines, well, they need to have started yesterday or 10 years ago. Or in some cases, for our collective disciplines, 100 years ago. I mean, if you think about it now, our discipline for protecting the earth pays off not only for us, but for generations to come. And our restraint now, our discipline now, is what would allow life and freedom to exist for generations to come. Using freedom requires a discipline. Disciplines that must start yesterday or beyond to take effect, and yet here we are in today. And so the question that is posed to us is, what do you want to be free to do in your life right now? What do you want to be free to do? What do you want to be free to be? And not simply shrugging off the constraints of another, but what right now does your inner capacity not allow you to be or do that you yearn and desire? What quality in yourself? Years ago, I heard this story. It's preached by a Unitarian Universalist minister, and for the life of me, I can't remember if it was a work of fiction, their own recollections, or just some, maybe even classic story. I don't even know about. But it stuck with me, and it's a story about a well. The story goes that a family lived on a farm for generations. They cultivated the land. They lived in the house. It's kind of one of those farmhouses that you would constantly add additions to as the family grew. You look at it, and it's kind of awkward in how it's put all together, and yet sort of beautiful. Like, you see the growth of the family, like the rings of a tree expanding. Now, the family, as the parents aged, the siblings decided they didn't want to keep up the work of the farm, and so they all moved to the city. They all moved to the various places and took jobs, and it was just the mom and the dad who lived on the farm until they both passed away. And so the siblings gathered together and went back to the farm. They were getting it ready to be sold, but they wanted to go back one last time to experience that connection of their childhood. So they went there, and they went through all of the rooms. They walked through the fields, and they all kind of looked at each other and realized they were desiring the same thing, which was to drink of the water from a well, the well that had been the primary source for the feet, for the animals, for themselves, for the washing, for the cleaning up. And so they walked over to the well that had been covered long ago, and they pried open the cover, and they got the bucket and found some like rope that they had brought to tie one of the things down, and they dropped the bucket into the well. When the bucket landed, it was a thud, not a splash. The water wasn't there. And what they learned was that the actual act of taking the water from the well changes the pressure in the soil. It wasn't that the water down deep in the aquifers and the water table was gone. It was that the act for all of those generations of dropping the bucket and bringing it up would change the pressure and would allow the water to be pulled up from the deepest sources up to be accessed. And so in the years in which they had moved away, in which the well had fallen into disuse, the water had receded down. It hadn't had that pull of connection. This story has always stuck with me because it feels like this perfect image for this work that we do. A lot of times, we don't want to drop the bucket down and haul the heavy water up from the bottom. We'd rather just turn on the tap, right, and have it come to us. And yet the discipline of the work of dropping the bucket allows the tendrils and tributaries to go down into the deepest sources of living water. It is the practice that not only nourishes us in its work and its discipline, but provides water for those who come next. It's odd to me that I found such resonance in this Lord's Prayer. It is a prayer that is not mine. It's been a prayer that humans have been praying for centuries, thousands of years even. And yet, in some ways, I was gifted it, gifted this tool that I could use to find connection to that deep meaning in my own way. And yet it's taken the repetition of these days and this relationship with these kids to find its place. And so for this series, we are going to invite you into a set of collective practices, spiritual practices that we're all going to do together. Now, I know some of you are starting to fold the hands of your heart over each other. Like, wait, who was on the committee that decided these practices? I don't remember getting the notice of meeting so I could vote on them. And even then, you're not the boss of me. You can't tell me what to do. I'll do whatever I damn please. And of course, you're free to. There is no coercion in covenant. There is no coercion and no way that I could force you to do any of these things, even if I wanted to. But what we're getting at is an invitation to that deeper freedom of maybe giving up a little bit of our control and seeing what depth we can create together in trusting with a holy curiosity some practices that have for centuries sustained human beings, even if they aren't the first tool that we go to. And so here they are. You're invited, and you're going to receive one of these on your way out. You're invited to pray every day using these prayer beads. Our staff have been furiously making one for each of you. So I'm guilting you now. You're also going to receive a discipline guide here that talks about each of these practices. And so for the prayer practice on page 3, it goes through each of the beads. Each of the different colors of the beads has a different invitation. An invitation to listen, to breathe, to name what is sacred, to listen for the places in your life that there are pain, to acknowledge the places where love is needed, and to affirm your place in the web of life. For each of those prayers, you would move one of the beads towards the little heart charm at the bottom. And you're invited to do this every day for 29 days, which is 29 times, which is probably not what you are already doing. And yet, I wonder what will happen for you and your family as you try this practice. And that's the beauty that we get to do it together, that we get to learn from each other. So that's the first practice. And if that wasn't enough, right? I mean, it can take anywhere from 5 to 30 minutes to do this, depending on your life. I would say, you know, aim for 5 at the start, see where you end up. But if that wasn't enough, we're inviting you to another practice, which is, I think we have a slide on this, if our if that person wants to find it. The second practice is a table blessing, which is that before you eat any food, we invite you to pause and to give thanks. To give thanks for the place in the web of life that we find ourselves in. We've offered you some words that you can use and a practice for your family of naming joys and sorrows and places of gratitude. We invite you every time you eat, and I'm going to be doing this too, every time you eat, to pause and to see how that changes your interaction with your fellow meal companions or the food that you eat. And then finally, probably the most controversial, and those of you who are reading ahead are like, what are they talking about? The last is a weekly fast. So fasting is a spiritual practice that has been around for centuries. Our Jewish friends just went through their day of fast during the Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah. Our Muslim brothers and sisters, they go through Ramadan, this period, this month-long fast in which they don't eat or drink water when the sun has risen or is up. You're not going to have to do a whole month. Don't worry. We're just inviting you for one day a week, so for the next 4 weeks, to fast. And we know that fasting, both for physical and sometimes mental reasons, abstaining from food isn't a good choice for a lot of us. And so we're inviting you to fast from food or from technology. That for 24 hours, you would give up your screens, your TVs, your cell phones, your computers, your tablets, your laptops, looking at the football game that's in the restaurant that you're eating at, all of it. Fasting is this invitation to empty ourselves out, to see what is inside, to make room for listening for what is true and alive in our lives. It is a risky and yet beautiful thing. So how many of you are like, I'm 100% in? How many of you are like, it's like 60%? How many of you are like 20%? How many of you are in the like, heck no category? All right, you got one over there. There is something powerful that happens in us trying this together. That we might be able to interrupt the mindlessness, that we can actually help one another. We can say, hey, I just had my fast day. It was awful. How's yours going? You can maybe find an accountability buddy to text each other to say, remember to do your prayer beads. I know you forgot yesterday. That happens to me. To help you out with that, we're inviting you, and if we go to the next slide, to join with us, like physically, to say you're in by texting commit to 97000. I know, this is like, what is it? Like a shopping channel? Like, just do this. And the reason we invite you to do this is we're going to send a kind of 3 to 4 text messages throughout the week, just to reminders or links to articles about how to build practices or testimonials from each other to, you know, that Gretchen had a really great experience and she's going to share it with you, or, you know, this Gretchen over here had a terrible experience, and she's like, you should do it this way and not that way. A way of us being in it together. So you can do that now, or there are these cards in the seat back pockets where you can write your phone number or your email address, and you can get those same messages. Just another way of us cultivating this work together. My hope and desire for this month of collective practice is that for all of us, we will get to approach an old well. We get to approach an old well and pour in some new water. And that water will filter down into those deep places of nourishment. And each day, as we add more water, the connections will be made so the water will be available to us when we most need it. When the discipline is truly needed, not today, but in that future, when we wished we would have started years ago. Can't wait to see what happens. Amen. And blessed be.